I think about AI at this point almost professionally. It is the subject of so much of my writing, lots of these podcasts, and so much of the back-end stuff we're experimenting with throughout Mocha. And yet, as you'll hear constantly throughout this episode, I understand painfully little of AI's actual history, its important figures, and honestly, how it even works. So today's episode is about changing that. I met today's guest fairly recently, and having spoken to him in a different arena, realized quickly that the artist and developer Human is gifted not only at wielding AI for all manner of purposes, artistry chief amongst them, but for talking about AI in a way that feels comprehensible and comprehensive at the same time. Throughout today's conversation, I felt like I was finally being introduced to the underpinnings of how this entire AI ecosystem came to be. Human is an excellent teacher, nitty-gritty technician, and historian, as you'll hear throughout the next hour. Being quite important in the development of the original Stable Diffusion model, which has since become the kind of keystone AI art model in use today, Human takes us through his own history with GAN models and latent diffusion models, helps us understand how and why Stable Diffusion came to be, and unpacks the all-important future of AI, how to incentivize open source developers, blockchain's role in AI development, and much more. I trust you will enjoy Human's insight as much as Colborne and I did on this week's Mocha Live podcast. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Mocha Live podcast. It is 5 o'clock p.m. on the dot. Colborne, we have like a streak of like 4 or 5 weeks going of getting here right on time. I would just like to shout us out for doing an excellent job. So well done to us. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today on the podcast. My name is Max Cohen. I'll be one of your hosts today. Joining me, as always, is Colborne Bell, founder of the Museum of Crypto Art. Colborne, how are we finding you today?
Very good. Thank you.
Excellent. And our guest today is a brilliant AI mind and artist whose work you can actually see on your screen right now. It's blowing my mind, and I will probably be distracted by it a time or two throughout this conversation. His work ranges from landscapes to architecture to abstractions. He was part of the creation process for the original Stable Diffusion model, so a wealth of technical expertise, as well as
deforms.
I prefaced before we even got on that I was going to make technical errors all throughout this podcast. So let's just get right to it. This is Human. Human, thank you so much for being on the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
An absolute pleasure. So AI, big topic.
AI.
Let's dive in.
Have you heard about it? With AI? The time for today. This is getting off to a fantastic start. There's no great way to get into such a giant conversation.
Just let's have Human give their backgrounds. I'd like to hear that if...
Yeah. Sounds good. So I think I started in 2021. I was experimenting with GANs. Actually, I had finished my master's degree. I have like a master's in applied physics. And sort of the summer after I got my degree, I was trying to figure out what to do. And, you know, I'm like a sketch artist, or I was a photographer. And I had just learned a bunch about computer programming and wanted to sort of, you know, tackle some technical problem in the scope of art creation. And ultimately, like, that desire led to me finding GANs and starting to experiment with GANs. I got like a 3070, I believe, in like peak GPU shortage. It was like terribly expensive. I think it was like, you know, $1,800 for a 3070, which is probably worth like $600 now. But at the time, it just felt like a really important step for me.
What are we up to at the moment? GPU. It's like 3090s are the ones?
4090s. Yeah. Like, and maybe even later this year, 5090s.
Not that I have any idea what those numbers mean, but I
just
know
keep
higher
buying is that NVIDIA stock.
Yeah. I can't. I don't like buy stocks usually.
what about shit coins? How do you feel about shit coins? Sorry.
Well, really, yeah, there's loads of them.
Really derailed this conversation.
Yeah,
starting off. Please keep going. Yeah.
But I essentially was experimenting with GANs, and I think at the time it was like 128 pixels by 128 pixels, you know, these really small things that looked like shit. They were just like blobs. I think like Robbie Barrett had a repo that he forked, which I found, which basically like scraped a bunch of art from Wikipedia and then used that in the creation of GANs. So that was kind of like my introduction to AI. And, you know, obviously I just fell in love with it. And it just felt like, I don't know, walking through a portal into a new dimension where I have all of these cool, awesome skills and abilities. And there's like this wealth of knowledge and information to learn. I think like my first 2 weeks working in the AI space felt like 2 months. And I mean that literally. And I think a lot of people who sort of fall down the rabbit hole experience something similar to that. But ultimately, right, like I started getting involved in the Discord communities. There was a bunch at the time. There was one in particular called VClips. And a bunch of like the biggest, most prominent AI artists were all in that Discord, sort of just sharing knowledge, sharing their weird, funky creations. At the time, the tech was really bad. And sort of that like spirit of, you know, supporting each other, helping each other was just like very formative for me and is something that I'm like actively trying to preserve. So in 2022, when Stable Diffusion came out, I created this open source project called Deforum. And essentially it started as like a small group of OG AI artists who were building a Colab notebook. And it like very quickly grew into this like massive community Discord. One of Deforum's like claims to fame is the like first Stable Diffusion implementation of like animation. And ultimately, like because of that, because of the work that like Pharmapsychotic did in bringing or porting over like Disco Diffusion animation into this Deforum Stable Diffusion notebook, we, you know, amassed this amazing community of AI artists, enthusiasts, etc. And I think right now we have like 29,000 people in our Discord. Wow. Like actively participating in conversation, you know, really pushing the boundary of like what these tools can do. So that's my background. Also I did some AI NFT stuff.
Well, you know, a question that I always find pertinent is, do you consider yourself an artist who develops AI or a developer who creates art? And I recognize in that question that I'm inviting like snarky answers. So please don't be shy to give me one.
Yeah, I always consider myself like an artist first, right? Like there's something deep down inside me that just wants to make stuff, right? Like in for it to just be cool. It doesn't have to do anything, right? Like these blobs on the screen, it's just blobs. Like it doesn't need utility. It doesn't need to be like part of some, you know, blockchain, whatever. Like I just like making stuff. So I always consider myself an artist first. And that's kind of just like how I approach everything. Of course, I love technical challenges and problems. And, you know, there's just a lot to explore in sort of the AI space.
So when it comes to like, I don't know, data setting a model or training a model rather, or even just like creating something like Stable Diffusion or helping to like build out what became like this, you know, multi-nodal beast of a program, how does like the artistic desire in you or the creative side, how does that manifest in the process of creating an AI like this?
Yeah. So I was talking with some people at NFT Paris, some like AI artists, like a few weeks ago. And someone in particular brought up this like really important point that for an artist, right? Like when an artist makes something, it's just the beginning, right? Like it's just the start of something, as opposed to like when an engineer makes something, it's complete, right? Like if I define a problem and I define a solution and I you know, create a list of essentially check boxes to meet, right? For an engineer, as soon as those check boxes are met and, you know, everything on my list is checked off, right? Like the problem solved, it's done, right? And I move on to the next one. For an artist, right? Like we're constantly trying to figure out what else to put on that list. So like when I'm developing a tool or building a data set, it's like, great, you know, I made this, you know, tool that can scrape any website and I have this auto captioner, but okay, now I need to find like the next thing to point it towards, right? Like there's sort of just this constant chase to improve what you're building. And that's kind of like how I see things.
Yeah, it's fascinating, especially, and I've spoken about this before, like the writing process is, I mean, obviously it's not anything like engineering, but it is focused on completion, right? Once the thing is written and published and comes out, you know, your time to like discover newness, your time to like change the output is over, right? There is just like the before it is published and the after, and the thing is like finalized in that moment. And I do think there's something fascinating about the possibility of like, especially the creative training of AI models, where they're constantly internalizing new information, constantly getting a little bit better at exploring this concept or generating this aesthetic, that I find really interesting. And that's just one of many interesting things that I want to get to today. You know, I want to make sure we talk about like open source development and the next evolutions of AI art and like bringing access to these programs to the public. But I want to jump back into your past and also the past of AI, because I think that as we get more advanced with these tools, these like early periods of AI development, pre-Stable Diffusion, pre-DeForum, pre-Midjourney and DALL-E, the history is threatened to get lost a little bit. So I was hoping you could tell us a little bit more about like what the state of the AI ecosystem was like when you first entered into it, finding these GANs, joining these Discord communities, like when you decided that this was, you know, when it was capturing your time and also your prowess, like what was the overall environment like?
I might struggle to like draw parallels here, just because for me, it was sort of unlike anything else that I experienced. But essentially, it's just the three of us, right? Like in a Discord chat, just talking about random AI things that, you know, we experimented with. You know, we have clip guidance. We have different parameters that we can tweak, maybe a handful. And, you know, you're doing an experiment. I'm doing an experiment. Like we just compare notes. Hey, oh, you tried 1,000 steps. What did that look like? Oh, hey, I tried a guidance scale of 100K. Like, what did that look like? And it's just sort of people experimenting in the open. And there's kind of just like less noise in the space because it's not this like hype thing, right? It almost feels like a little fringe, I think, in the beginning, where people are doing these things and it's like, oh, that's cool, that's great. But you're just making blobs. And like, I'm not really like sold on this whole AI thing. When I started, right, like I was showing my friends in person what I was doing and they're like, oh, that's cool, that's cool. Like in reality, it was kind of lame, but, you know, I just thought it was so fascinating. But the point is that like, it was like a very intimate community and group, right? Like I could reach out to, Ganbrood, for instance, and just like ask him some questions. I could reach out to Rainisto and just, you know, chat with him for like 30 minutes at a time. Now it's hard to get these people's attention and focus.
Do you think the ecosystem changed dramatically once there became a kind of expectation that you would mint these pieces or at least market them as opposed to just straight exploration of the concept?
No. So I think it was in 2022, there was like this big sort of like Tezos wave of like AI art on Tezos and sort of like these early AI artists minting their work. I think that was like the peak when it came to creativity in the space with these tools. I think the sort of feeling that like, you know, close-knit community feeling disappeared as soon as like the money came in and, you know, these companies were trying to monetize this stuff. Like, because attention, right, is like so hard, you know, everyone is fighting for your attention. And when you have this like community of AI artists working with tools that make blobs, like, you know, it's no one really cares. And, you know, I'm not fighting for the attention of these people. But as soon as, you know, Midjourney proved that, you know, this could be turned into a commercial product that's like super successful. And then, you know, Leonardo comes in right after and like follows suit. All of these companies start like piling into the space and just like fighting for everyone's attention. Right. And like, as soon as that happened, the quality of the information that was being shared just went down dramatically. And like the quality of the interactions that people were having just went down dramatically. And now it almost feels like, you know, you enter the space and you're sort of like siloed off from all of these other creators and you don't get to communicate with them because like your introduction into the space is through like this predefined, you know, guardrailed Midjourney app or like DALL-E app. Like there's no social features built into these. And like these companies, although they're really smart and they can make amazing models, aren't doing you any favors in like teaching you how this stuff works. And like, that's what's missing.
So that's a great point. And it leads into something I want to ask you, Colborn, which is we at Mocha have been experimenting with some AI stuff and it required the downloading of Comfy UI and the use of stable diffusion models like Bastard, Juggernaut. And you in the past couple of weeks, since we did this together, have generated just a seismic amount of outputs. And I know that you were doing a lot of AI work before for your 0-1 mints, and I'm not sure what you were using for those. But I'm curious, like, you've now had pretty recent and kind of prolific exposure to the other side of this, right? From what Human was talking about, right? Like very parameter oriented, very specifiable AI generation, as opposed to using these tools that are maybe more generalized. And I'm curious if you've learned any lessons or there's anything particularly about the difference in these processes that have caught your attention.
Well, I mean, I think it's incredible that me with no coding experience can be able to access at a pretty high level. This is almost true open source. And that's always something that I've always been pretty good at, you know, whether it's figuring out in the beginning, like how to like torrent and download things or like what it takes to like get a crypto wallet. You can be non-technical and still experience technology. And that ability to kind of like stay creative and open and desiring to be there on, you know, on the back of technical people is obviously how technology spreads and proliferates. So yeah, it's exciting and incredible to see. And the outputs are, they're just brilliant and they're humorous. And yeah, I've been doing a lot of hours and hours of generations. I don't know, man, just to feel the power of this technology, where it's going, how society will be impacted in the next 3, 5, 10 years. It's one of those things that I think nothing will be bigger than the convergence of AI and blockchain.
Do you think you could feel that as powerfully if you're only using these kinds of, I'm not sure the correct word, I'm going to use the word gatekept, even though I'm not sure it's totally accurate, but like the Midjourneys and the DALL-Es where you don't really have the individual parameters, you're just kind of like interacting with the thing in a very simplistic way, put in your prompt, output generates. Do you think you can get a real sense of like the scope of AI and the fact that it's going to overtake everything using?
I mean, we were playing with Karin's the Noose Research World Simulator. Have you played with that, Human?
So I was on the, was it like a demo call yesterday or like 2 days ago?
Yeah.
I saw it.
Wild. I mean, it's just wild. The scope of what it can conceptualize and distill and convey and having all of that access to information. It feels that we are just like so far past, you know, Midjourney and where we're going to be in a year will be crazy in 2 years. And I think all of this, marking this progression, capturing this progression, putting it on the blockchain, will form like a career and arc of artistry being on the bleeding edge of these technical tools.
Well, let's go back to like, I want to kind of pinpoint this moment, right? Just before Stable Diffusion, you helped to kind of create Stable Diffusion Human, right? Because before that, as you said, and to my understanding, in like 2017, 2018, 2019, it was all GAN models that were kind of being widely used. And we see the adherence to historical provenance being highly valued with artists like Videodrome and Zaza and Bard Janssen, and their works getting kind of scooped up from Super Rare and Mass. And my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that GAN models, you know, you were saying that you can get like, what, 128 times 128 pixels. They were cumbersome and they were kind of limited in possibility. And then Stable Diffusion has now exploded in the last couple of years to be kind of the standard open source kind of model base, if you will, for what most brilliant AI artists are using. And I'm curious, like, why were you compelled to begin building Stable Diffusion, and what did you hope it would achieve? And like, how were you using it at its outset and its like earliest moments?
Yeah, so I'll do like a brief history lesson. So the GANs, the generative adversarial networks. Yeah. So essentially the way that these models work is you're training essentially a generator, and like, or you can think of it this way. You're generating an art forger and an art critic at the exact same time. And so you have this training set of data. The forger looks at the training set and tries to produce an image that looks like the training set. The art critic looks at the forger's work and also looks at the training data set and decides whether or not it's like forged or real. And so you essentially have the system for essentially incentivizing the art forger to get better and the art critic to get better. And so like you incentivize these two systems to work essentially in tandem towards the goal of creating a really high quality image generator. And, you know, this was like a really novel, I guess, like idea and technique for creating generative models. But ultimately, like if anyone listening has like tried to train a GAN model, it's really difficult, right? Like there's all these sort of ways that the training run can be ruined essentially because the training itself is like very delicate and unstable. So you have to do like a lot of work in order to train these models. So what ended up happening is a new model architecture came onto the scene, which was a diffusion model. And basically, instead of sort of doing like a one pass through this neural network to generate an image, you sort of like generate an image iteratively by denoising, by adding noise and removing that noise. When I started, it was with GANs. And pretty quickly, there were these clip guided diffusion models in the space, and I was experimenting with those. The most notable sort of like tools at the time were Disco Diffusion, which was created by Somni, who works at Midjourney. And also another big contributor to that project was Gandamu, who works at Stability. But these clip guided diffusion models essentially were using a clip model, which is like an image recognition model, in order to like guide the diffusion towards, you know, desired output, whether it be like Cat Sushi or Untitled Abstract Futurism. But what eventually people figured out is that you could do the actual diffusion in a latent space as opposed to an RGB space. And what this essentially did is it like made the whole process a lot more efficient. It made the model more complex, but that basically gave birth to latent diffusion models, which is like what we're all using today, which is like basically you're performing diffusion in the latent space. And Stable Diffusion is a latent diffusion model. You know, most of the most popular models that people are using today are all sort of like latent diffusion models. Sorry, I got like way too technical there.
No, that's so perfect. Yeah, I need this.
But what was my point?
Well, so how did great question.
We don't know. Yeah.
Stable Diffusion seems to me to be kind of the poster child for like open source AI development, and latent diffusion models being kind of like the technical base for a lot of these, especially within the art world. And, you know, I think we collectively,
at least as a small cutting edge interested art movement, want to get away from the Midjourney and the DALL-E and this kind of like unspecific prompt-based big tech gate-kept AI models. When that is desired, it's usually latent diffusion or stable diffusion that gets mentioned. Why do you think that stable diffusion specifically, and maybe this is just an extension of the answer about latent diffusion, has been so embraced by the wider kind of tech-savvy art world?
Yeah, so I think specifically it's because of EMAD, right? You know, news recently, EMAD left Stability, but I think it's because of him, you know, stable diffusion is so successful.
This is EMAD is the former CEO.
And it's not that he's like super uber, like technically smart when it comes to like the training of these models or the inferencing of these models. It's because he just was in this space with me, right? Like I mentioned these close-knit Discord communities, like EMAD was there. Like I would talk to him, you know, and he was just a normal person at the time, right? And, you know, I think because he was like part of this community, he understood what the community wanted. And, you know, he knew who all the talented people were and like what they wanted to build. And I think he was able to like support those people. And that's ultimately like what led to Stable Diffusion being so successful, is that this like recognition of like who we're building this model for, right? And I think without that, Stable Diffusion wouldn't have been as successful as it was. So like my involvement in Stable Diffusion was being part of this like alpha Discord. So, you know, before Stable Diffusion was released and before it was branded as Stable Diffusion, it was just latent diffusion Discord. And I was interacting with this bot and we were all sort of rating images, and our ratings were essentially helping train an aesthetics model, which would later refine the training data set. So basically, by being part of this alpha Discord, I played like a very small role in directing the aesthetics of Stable Diffusion, like the base models that were produced.
There are now thousands. I believe there are thousands. There's at least very many variations of the Stable Diffusion model. What's it like seeing this thing that you worked on so heavily and you were there at the inception of kind of getting changed and redefined and molded and then turned loose onto so many projects just all over the world?
Yeah, so I mean, I was always very aware of like the biases in the model. So early on, it was really bad at abstract imagery and specifically like really fine details and lines. And that was always something that I was like really frustrated by, is the fact that it could like make a really beautiful anime portrait, but it couldn't make nice geometric abstract shapes and forms. I'm like super happy that sort of just by this model being out in the open, and because of the fact that people have access to this model and they can fine tune it however they like, kudos to Stability for like open sourcing all this stuff. We get this diversity of output that is like more representative of what people think is actually cool, right? It's not just anime waifus and I don't even know, orange and teal. Like there's a lot more to art than just like what we see in the AI space. And that's true even today, right? Like all of these models come with their own sort of like inherent biases. And yeah, that's something that like I'm really obsessed with trying to remove. But it's not an easy problem, right? Like the training of Stable Diffusion 1.5, I think cost $500,000, right? And that's just a single model. And think about all of the models that they've tried to train and failed. We're talking like millions of dollars to train a model. Like I don't have $1 million to train a model. I don't have 8,000 GPUs sitting around. Like I can't do these things. So what's amazing is the fact that like by basically sharing knowledge as opposed to creating products, like the whole community and spaces move forward in the sense that we can now train models more efficiently because we have like more sophisticated architectures. What once cost $500,000 to train now might only cost like $50,000, right? Mm-hmm. And like, if you're willing to make some like compromises, you know, that might only cost you $5,000. And what's amazing is that, like, you know, everyone here in this call, everyone listening can do this stuff. And it's like not that hard. Like, you got to know where to look, but it's not that hard.
Okay. I want to dwell on that point because I think it's really, really important. You know, I believe you that it's not that hard, but I think we're fighting against public perception in ways that are really, really difficult. You know, I had mentioned that the Mocha team kind of got on a call and we installed Comfy UI. And for me specifically, as somebody who has no computing or coding experience at all, it was kind of a bear of a process, like fishing around in root folders and using terminal commands, just kind of like crossing my fingers and hoping that I did it right. So that's part one, right? Part two is that I have a 2022 MacBook Pro that's a pretty damn good computer with an M1 Pro chip, and it's just not really capable of generating quality outputs on a stable diffusion model that is worthy of too much time, right? It takes my computer about 35 minutes if it wants to generate any kind of output, which is just not really applicable unless I want to spend, you know, all my waking hours, unless I'm really, really savvy at determining, you know, how different noise and parameters will affect the outcomes. Regardless, my point is just that, like, this is everyone's problem because the perception, even from doing it, is that it's so technologically difficult to use, download the Stable Diffusion and other open source models that the longer that goes on, the more market share these kind of like behemoth models, so the Midjourneys and the OpenAI products across the board, will get, right? And Sora, the OpenAI video generation model, is, I believe, not that far away. And I can't imagine that won't be another couple steps of technical competency for someone like myself to download and, you know, efficiently use open source models that are going to be able to create something, you know, comparable. From your conversations within the AI developmental world, like, how much of a priority is this accessibility right now and getting costs down and getting the process simplified?
Yeah.
It sounded like there was going to be another question there, but I just.
I think it is the priority, right? Like, AI and crypto, right? Like, what does that look like? You know, there's things like BitTensor, there's things like Render. These are sort of like very novel attempts at sort of like this future that we're sort of thinking about. But I think AI and crypto enables a lot of things. And like, what does that enable, right? Like, I could potentially tap into an entire network of GPUs just with like some crypto coins. And all of a sudden, you know, what I can create is factors greater than what I can do on my MacBook. And another point I wanted to make was that, like, the Midjourneys, the Leonardos, like, all of these AI products are just selling compute at the end of the day, right? Like, they make the most money off of, you know, buying GPUs at X price and selling it to you for like 3, 4, even 10 times that, just because they, you know, tacked on some fancy model. But the reality is like, those margins are going to go to zero. So, you know, yes, today it's really hard. Like, a year from now, it's going to be easier. 2 years from now, it's going to be even easier. And like, at what point does it like not even matter, right? Like, what Midjourney can do. I think that's like an important thing to think about and an important question, right? Like, how much better do these models need to get before we just don't care?
So, I mean, that is kind of, it's very much a statement against any sort of centralization and packaging. And obviously, I think it's probably in your ethos that everything is developed open source, that as much, you know, bias is removed from these models. Where do you see, it's hard to say, but where do you see the future of this, if it's kind of, it always blows my mind to think about non-commercial products and how people like support and develop these things. Would you see this as almost like a Wikipedia on steroids?
Yeah. I mean, that's a good question. And I'm speaking about things from sort of like my ethical perspective, you know, like from my background is where we started. And that's kind of how, you know, I've like carried that with me throughout this conversation. But there are obviously like more sides to this, right? Like, I think Midjourney is an amazing tool. Like, it's an incredible tool. And, you know, it's made by incredible people. And like, I'm not trying to discredit sort of these companies and the products that they're putting out there, because the reality is they're saving a lot of people time, right? They're saving people time and they're, you know, abstracting away all of the complexity. But in my mind, right, like in the sustainable future, right, this technology is so integral that, you know, our first thought when we want to make something is, okay, like, you know, how can I make this myself? Not what products exist that can do this. And I don't know if anyone listening or here has tried to like just program something with LLMs and like ChatGPT. It's like, it's way more accessible today than it ever was. So I would just be maybe like surprised and disappointed if in the future, you know, like I couldn't just, I don't know, have an app on my phone that makes Midjourney models like and trains them.
So societally, do you think it is a great equalizer, or is it something that will pull people apart, if that makes sense?
I mean, yeah, I guess I haven't really thought that far. Or What do you think?
I don't know. That it just fascinates me. I can see it both ways. It's hard to think in decade scale. Because imagine, right, if you work with an LLM to code anything, then, you know, in the future, kind of what is the purpose of being a coder? What is the purpose of any specialized knowledge? And all of society, capitalism in general, thrives on specialized knowledge and production, right? And if there is, you know, some generalized artificial intelligence that is common and widespread and universally known, then at some point, it's less about having very specific specialized knowledge and more about what you can orchestrate and coordinate.
From a marketing / economic / just your opinion perspective, Coborn, how does an open source community of developers who is not profit-minded, How do you put pressure on large companies like, you know, your Googles, your Microsofts, your OpenAIs, your whomever, to create products more in line with the kind of open source ideal? Is there a way, or are those forces, in your opinion, always at odds with each other?
I mean, Human, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't Meta now pushing an open source agenda?
I'm not sure like what their strategy is, but they've definitely open sourced some amazing models like Llama, right? Llama 2.
So how do you put pressure? I mean, I think that walled gardens pretty much always fall. We kind of see what's happening with Apple right now. It's really an attack at the gates.
In what sense? Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Well, you know, for however long, they have kept everything in their ecosystem, right? And if you want access to the 2 billion phones, you need to go through the App Store, right? Mm-hmm. And they are gatekeeping that. I think they just got hit with the... didn't they just get hit with the lawsuit?
Yeah. DOJ, I mean, they're constantly getting hit, yeah. But yeah. Europe is putting a lot of pressure on them. Like, I think the biggest win for me was when they put pressure on them to make iPhones have USB-C.
Right. So you're not constantly buying new cables. But look, the fact of the matter like remains that we are at such a critical junction. These tech giants have built up and centralized themselves on really the back of the internet. And, you know, I've said now that like all of the power that these giant institutions had in the 90s and 2000s and those periods of time that we were growing up, we now have that similar power as individuals, right? So like our ability behind this computer screen to like trade and move capital and invest is really analogous to like a 90s, 2000s hedge fund. So what is the power of that centralization, of that orchestration in an age when access to the tools is not the problem, but who is orchestrating the best? So is it going to be like a rogue band of just like brilliant people in a Discord, or is it going to be the engineers that go like self-select to work at Google? And I think like what Human is pointing to is an experience that I had similarly when I first got into crypto, is that it's the passionate people in those small groups that are exploring esoteric things that really move the needle. It's not the person like putting on their khakis and polo shorts or polo shirts and going into like the Google office for something that is like mundane and routine.
Well, I think so much Human, were you going to say something? Sorry.
No, I just think that that's really interesting and insightful. I feel like I'll have something to say about it, but I need to think a little bit more.
Well, that's like the problem with having all these conversations, is they still feel so theoretical, because any opinion that we have today could very rightly be changed in a month by some news coming out, some new development that's happening in a back end that we're not totally aware of. I think a lot about UI UX in terms of how this ultimately shakes out, because I think that for the 99% of people, we're already at a level of sophistication with these models that is so batshit that any more sophistication on top of it, which might excite the 1% of developers, the 1% of AI artists, is almost null and void when it comes to convincing people to use this or that. And I think about, you know, if you told me that the newest, you know, the quote unquote newest stable diffusion model, I could download it with the click of a link. It's going to open some kind of app here or there that is very easy to load things in, load things out, that uses very low computing power, or there's an opportunity that seems very workflow or ease of workflow oriented, by which I can, as you said, use crypto coins to purchase more compute. I think that that would be a real motivator for people to explore this outside of, you know, these kinds of like the mid journeys and the open AIs, which I point to only because they don't give you a ton of choice. They don't give you a ton of like experimentation, like ability within the apps themselves. You kind of just have the one text box and then you go from there. But I think people love customizability. I think people love the fact that when Instagram, you know, dropped all these filters, and when Snapchat threw all these like face mask things, people still love to experiment with that for all sorts of different reasons, way more than if they just had like one choice. You know, it kind of like revitalized, I think, both brands in a sense. And so I wonder how far we are from tools that are so sophisticated on the back end, but so interconnected with each other, that even like a complete tech novice like me, who may have like an experimental bent, no self-confidence in tech stuff, is able to just through a really easy workflow, get access to these models, get access to compute that is not either readily available or readily obvious, and just start generating. And I don't know how far away we are from that. Maybe you have a better idea of how far away we are from that.
Well, so I have like a question, which is like, how do you incentivize the like open source contributions and development? How do you incentivize people who are in Discords, you know, moving the needle? Like, what does that incentive structure look like? And that's kind of like a burning question for me.
Yeah, the reverse question is, what do those people want?
Well, I think those people want recognition. They want resources to build more, right? If that's their goal, you know, obviously I'm kind of like implying open source, they're building tools, that they're developing something.
So Noose Research does something interesting, and I hope that I don't bungle the explanation of it from what I believe, but it is my understanding that at least part of Noose Research's business model slash structure is that they have a kind of leaderboard oriented kind of like incentivized arms race between AI developers to build models that can be as good or better than GPT-4 in certain metrics. And then those developers are incentivized automatically with Tau, which is the BitTensor blockchain's proprietary coin, based on your standing in that blockchain. Now, again, that requires access to a huge fund of capital up front that just outright believes in open AI development. But perhaps there is something, I mean, as there is with everything related to AI and blockchain, there are all these really creative synergies there. Perhaps it is about using these incentives to get people to use a platform that then benefits from use, right? Open source AI developers want incentives, blockchains, et cetera, want eyeballs, apps, users, et cetera. And I'm really interested in that dichotomy and how those two things can expand on each other. Because if there's a chain that's going to be competing with other chains for the attention and commitment of the open source AI community, that's worth a whole hell of a lot when it comes to, you know, getting a coin to trade for a lot, getting applications built in a place, and then, you know, use that to move the market from there. Perhaps we can end on this, but Human, do you think that there's long-term possibility within that kind of model?
Yeah, so you mentioned the BitTensor subnet noose research. So yeah, there, I think, like, they created this incentive structure to basically reward people who are able to train models that can approximate GPT-4. So GPT-4 is like a closed model. It's considered by many to be like a state-of-the-art model, although things are always changing in the AI space. So, but the point is that they came up with this incentive structure for, you know, generating an incredibly valuable model that could be valuable to a lot of people. Sorry, I'm like sort of tripping over my words here, but what was the question?
More like, I appreciate that explainer because it was better than I could do. But do you think like a business model or an incentive structure like that has legs?
Yes.
/
Yes.
It can be applied to multiple different kinds of environments where the incentives, yes, are aligned on both ends.
100%. Like I definitely think these incentive structures can be built that utilize crypto in some way or another. I am unfortunately just like too stupid to do crypto blockchain stuff. Like I don't have the attention span. Like I don't know where to start. So I would love to work on that problem personally, but it seems like it's going to be inevitable at some point that we're going to be able to sort of like create these essentially crowdsourced models that outperform anything that Google can create or Microsoft, etc.
From your lips to God's ears, Human. That seems like a good place to stop for the day. Human, I want to give you a chance, a couple minutes, take as much time as you want. Would you tell everyone, you know, what you have going on, what you want them to know, how they can find you, et cetera, whatever you'd like. So please take the floor.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. I didn't know I'd be able to do this. I guess I would shout out DeForum, right? Like, this community of amazing artists and developers that are all sort of just like working on crazy AI visuals. And I think the future for AI video is going to be wild and crazy. And, you know, for people listening, I recommend you look up DeForum. That's DeForum.art, and just check out the website.
Rock and roll. Everyone should go check out DeForum. We will make sure that DeForum and Human, yourself, and all your various projects all get mentioned in the bio for this episode. So if anybody is listening to this and wants to know, simply go look at the bio and you will have all the information at your very fingertips. Colborn, any last words for us before we do our little outro here?
It's an interesting conversation always, but I find it very hopeful. I think this is how we get to where we want to go when we talk about decentralization, right? It's only through the idea and belief that, you know, group crowdsource models will be a better product than anything that a centralized entity will be able to create. Now, what that does to kind of like the nature of capitalism, the nature of capital, how blockchain gets integrated, how people are incentivized to do these things, we quickly kind of see like a really pivotal phase shift through this, where humans are changing, structures of societies are changing, the way we work, the way we interact. That's exciting for me because I think ultimately the world becomes a better place with this.
100%.
When I was a kid, I was using LimeWire and Napster. I wasn't buying music off, you know, iTunes. So people like open source things that they can use easily, and which provide them a similar product.
Information wants to be free.
Is the statute of limitations up on those crimes, Max?
I just checked out the UI and just fiddled with the settings. I never downloaded anything.
There you go.
Anyways, this has been an awesome, awesome conversation. You know when Colborne has last words that it was a stimulating conversation? Sorry, Colborne. That wasn't a dig. It was just more like a trend.
Normally, I want to get out of here, but I actually really did enjoy this conversation so much. I'd stay on for hours.
Yeah, could stay here all day. Unfortunately, we can't. But Human, we should definitely have you on again, and we can keep talking about this ad nauseum for hours and hours and hours throughout the next months and years.
Yeah, I love that. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Human, man.
Yeah, thank you, Human. Thank you, everyone, for being here. If you did enjoy what you heard today, please give us a review or a 5-star rating or a follow or a subscribe on Spotify, Apple, wherever you get these podcasts, so you know we have new things dropping. All these episodes are available to collect on Zora, so they are minted on the blockchain immutably for the future, God willing. Please check out some writing that we have going on our Substack at museumofcrypto.substack.com. This week, I wrote about, you guessed it, AI, because it's just on my mind all the time. So please check that out. Please check out Human at human.art. That's HUEMIN.art. We will, again, have all these links in the bio. Human, thank you so much. Colborne, thank you so much. Everyone out there, thank you so much. And we'll see you all real soon. Take care.
Peace.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. This podcast was edited and produced by me, Max Cohen. A big thanks to Human for being our guest today. A big thanks to Colborne Bell for being my co-host, as always. Thanks as well to Julian Brangold for composing our intro music, and to Day Fox for composing our cold open theme music. Most of all, thanks to you for listening. We wouldn't and couldn't do what we do without you, and we appreciate you being with us for another Mocha Live podcast. We hope to see you on the next one real soon. So long.